Hello, I'm Kirsty Young, and this is a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten the music. The programme was originally broadcast in 2008. My castaway this week is the broadcaster John Humphreys. For 21 years, the nation has woken up to him on the Today programme. Tea, toast and a generous helping of his tenacious style going down a treat with millions of his loyal listeners. The politicians he regularly skewers are unsurprisingly less enthusiastic. Jonathan Aitken once accused him of poisoning the well of democratic debate. His role as Grand Inquisitor is quite some way from his beginnings, as one of five children brought up in the poverty-stricken back streets of Cardiff. But it's a background that's informed and inspired him throughout his 50 years in journalism. For a long time, he has said, I had chips on both shoulders. They're still there, under the surface. You never quite get over things that happen in your childhood. So is it a strong sense of social injustice? Was it a strong sense of social injustice that propelled you into journalism in the first place?
A bit of that, a bit of jealousy, a bit of anger, a bit of frustration, a whole combination of things. You never quite know, do you, until much later.
Jealousy for those who had, when you had not.
I suppose so, and there was real poverty in the post-war years, and they were very bleak, those post-war years. It's easy to forget now, because it is, I say, only 60 years ago, but it's not that long ago in historical terms. But this was a very different world indeed. The country was a very different country indeed. You sort of began to get a feeling at that time that there was another place that you weren't being admitted to, that there were other good things happening and that you weren't being allowed to share in them. And I felt a bit puzzled at first, and then I suppose increasingly cross and jealous that we didn't have all of that.
What about that florid phrase of Jonathan Aitken's that you were poisoning the well of democratic debate with your style of interviewing? What did you make of it at the time?
Oh, I was terrified at the time. Yeah, I terrified is possibly slightly overdoing, but I was phoned at home. I can remember it ever so clearly, as you can with the important moments in your life. My then boss phoned and said, look, he's made this speech and we think this is potentially rather serious. And of course he was right. I actually thought that my career, such as it was, had come to an end at the Today programme. Because if others in the Cabinet, and he was a member of the Conservative Cabinet at the time, if others in the Cabinet had taken the same view and did not want to be interviewed by me, and that was the implied threat, the stated threat, in the Aitken speech, I couldn't continue to present the Today programme. That would be an end to it. And it wasn't really until the Monday when Ken Clark, God bless him, and Douglas Hurd, Lord Hurd, God bless him, both got onto the Today programme and said, look, we're not a part of this. And Ken Clark actually went on to the World at One to say, in effect, that he thought Aitken had been talking rubbish, that we realised it was going to swing in my favour.
Was that the occasion upon which you gave Ken Clark a calculator to work out how many times you were going to interrupt him during the interview? Is that
well,
the same?
Well, yes, because Aitken had said part of his case against me was that I had interrupted Ken Clark, I think he said 34 times in one short interview on the Today programme. So when Ken next came in, I did hand him a calculator, and he looked at the calculator. He was Chancellor of the Exchequer at the time, of course, and he said, you know, I never did figure out how to make one of these things work.
Nice line. Tell me about your first piece of music, then.
The first piece of music is Ella Fitzgerald. I have been terrified by two interviewees in my whole life, and I mean terrified. One of them was Margaret Thatcher, you'll not be surprised to hear. The other was Ella Fitzgerald. The problem with Ella Fitzgerald was that I failed to interview her. I was the editor of the teenage page of the Cardiff and District News, and Ella Fitzgerald came to Cardiff, and I went into her dressing room, and I was so scared and clumsy, imagine it, that my elbow caught a mirror, knocked it to the floor, smashed it, and she looked at me with rage and contempt and said, get that kid out of here. So I never actually did interview her, but to this day I tremble at the thought of it. Almost literally I can feel myself breaking out into a sweat as I describe it. But by God, could she sing?
Sweet push carts gently glide great big city's a wondrous toy, just made for a girl and boy. We'll turn Manhattan into an Isle of Joy.
Ella Fitzgerald and Manhattan. So you said you never quite get over things that happen in your childhood. Tell us about your childhood. How was it growing up in Splott, wonderfully named part of Cardiff?
Splott was a district of Cardiff, yeah. We were respectable poor. That's it. The height of wealth was a bowl of fruit on somebody's table when there was nobody ill in the house. You know, that was the mark of inordinate riches. We just didn't have much money.
Your father was a French polisher.
He was a French polisher, self-employed, so sometimes had no work.
He was a Tory.
He was a working-class Tory.
And a Republican.
And a Republican.
That's
confusing. No, I know.
Apparently contradictory.
He didn't fit any of the norms, no. He was once slung out of the Tory club because there was only one seat left on a crowded Friday night, one chair vacant, and it was beneath the picture of the Queen, and he refused to sit underneath. So they slung him out. He didn't like the royal family.
And you said, intriguingly,
didn't like authority of any sort. That was the point about him. That's what I got from him, I suppose.
I'm glad you said that. I was about to.
I saved you the trouble, didn't you?
When we began talking a few minutes ago, you said there was a sense somewhere, not quite tangible, that there were people somewhere else for whom life was a good deal better. Where was that coming from? How was it in the air?
Well, it came to me most clearly when, after the 11 plus, I went to a posh school, and almost all the kids there were middle class. So very occasionally, I would go home with one of them and see how the other half lived, as it were. But you didn't have a mix with it. There was a very, very clear social divide, very clear.
And the relative poverty then left you with a determination, I get the feeling, that it's never going to be like this for me.
Absolutely that.
And now, are you very careful with money?
I don't waste anything. It's one of the things I think you inherit. I am very, very, very conscious of waste, and I regard waste as wrong, morally wrong. Waste is a moral issue, not just a matter of practicality, but it's wrong.
Tell me about your next piece of music, then.
My first job outside Cardiff was in the Welsh Valleys, and one of the things I had to do was follow around, the labour of love, this, follow around the Penderus Male Voice Choir. The music was wonderful, but even more moving was the sight of these miners, because they were all miners, of course, standing on stage, looking utterly immaculate with their crisp blazers and white shirts and carefully knotted ties, and the veins, the lines in their hands and on their cheeks where the coal dust over the years had become ingrained. And I suppose one shouldn't over-romanticise this, but there was a sense of real dignity about them. These concerts were intensely, for me, intensely emotional affairs, nothing more so than when they were singing Mavanui.
The Penderus Male Voice Choir and Mavanui. And school then, you, as you say, your parents had made sure that you did the homework, you studied hard, you got into the high school, the equivalent of a grammar school. Nobody else in the street was there, so you were untypical to that extent. You were obviously bright, but you didn't enjoy school particularly.
Hated it, absolutely hated it. Partly the chip on the shoulder bit, but also because I was average, and I didn't have any real kind of social network there. I always felt that I didn't quite fit in. And I used to deliver newspapers to raise a few bob morning and evening. And it was particularly bad weather one morning, a lot of snow about. The papers were late arriving at the shop when I went to collect them. So I was late at school. I got school a bit late and was caned by the headmaster. And I'd explained to him why it had happened. And I think probably you might have expected a headmaster to say, well, look, in those circumstances, you know, you weren't skiving off, you were out there in the driving snow, battling through the blizzard to deliver newspapers to earn some money for your family. That's actually rather a good thing, but not a bit of it I got caned anyway. And that really hurt in all sorts of ways. I never forgave him for that.
So at the age of 15, you walk into the Penarth Times. It's 1958. You wanted to be Clark Kent.
I wanted to be Clark Kent. Well, yeah, we, the only comics we got, pretty much the only comics in those days that I remember anyway, were Superman comics, and Clark Kent became Superman, obviously, and Clark Kent was a reporter, therefore I wanted to be a reporter. Very, very childish and understandable maybe at the age of five, but to carry on with that thought into my 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, well, one wonders.
Tell me about your next piece of music then, track number three.
When I was in the Valleys, one of my closest friends was a chap called Giant Jones, who worshipped Duke Ellington, and I used to go with him to the concerts. In fact, it's one of my very proud boasts that many years later, when I was in New York, and I went to an Ellington concert in the Rainbow Rooms at the top of the Rockefeller Center, and I went for a wee in the interval, and there was the great man, and I stood next to him. Didn't speak to him, of course, and I wouldn't have dared, but oh, God, standing there next to Duke Ellington and having a bit, good God alive. And, of course, you associate Ellington with just one number. He played it at the start of every concert, A Train.
Duke Ellington and Take the A Train. So you joined the BBC in Liverpool in 1966.
Sounds about right.
You were 23.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember getting the job?
Yes, I do. There were two of us who were in the final shortlist, a chap called Mike Mackay and me. He was given a contract freelance job and I was given the staff job as district reporter for Liverpool and the North West, and it was probably the best job I've ever had, actually.
Why is that?
Well, just because it was my own patch, I was my own boss, and it was just a fabulous place to be. Liverpool was so exciting at the time, you know, Beatles and dock strikes, mostly dock strikes. I did spend an awful lot of time reporting dock strikes, but it was great to be independent, have your own patch at a time when there was a lot of news. And although I was working for Manchester ostensibly, a lot of my stuff was appearing on in London as well, so I was becoming part of the big news picture.
What did your parents make of the job?
Well, when they first saw me on telly, I think they were a bit stunned, really, because by and large boys from Splott didn't end up on the telly, by and large. But they were rather tickled by the whole thing.
Did they give you their opinion on your performance?
My father never did. My mother just said, oh, it's lovely, isn't it? No, that's all, really.
And you got married pretty young and had children in quite quick succession.
Yeah, I was married, as was fairly typical in those days, when I was just 2 and 21, and the babies came very quickly, so I was a very young father. Actually, I rather suspect I was pretty boring. Yeah, I was probably very boring at the time. I enjoyed life, but I was pretty boring.
Were you obsessed with your work?
I think not. I think you're obsessed with work if you don't enjoy doing anything else. That's obsession, isn't it? Yeah, I've worked hard. I've worked probably harder than most people around me for a variety of reasons, and that's, I suppose, not a bad thing, but maybe I've overdone it. Maybe, yeah, I think probably with the great benefit of hindsight, if I were to go back 30 or 40 years, I'd probably spend a little bit less time working and a little bit more time doing one or two other things, probably.
I mean, what I was wondering, what I was getting at there, was how much time you actually spent with your children when they were small. Much time at all?
I missed seeing my children grow up to some extent because I became a foreign correspondent quite early on. And from then on, spent 6, 7, sometimes 8 or 9 months of the year abroad. So I miss seeing my kids a lot. I remember once going on one trip, and my daughter, Catherine, was a baby when I left home and was a toddler when I came back. So I miss seeing her growing up and the first bits of the walking. That's sad. You shouldn't do that. I wouldn't recommend that to anybody.
More of your foreign adventures then in just a moment. Right now, tell me about your next piece of music.
Next piece of music is connected with America. Don McLean, most famous at the time, I suppose, for American Pie, but I think his most beautiful song was Vincent.
Swirling clouds in violet haze reflect in Vincent's eyes of china blue, colors changing hue. Morning fields of amber grain, weathered faces lined in pain, are soothed beneath the artist's loving hand.
Don McLean and Vincent, and that track, you say, reminding you, John Humphreys, of the time you spent in America. You were there during Watergate,
well,
during the impeachment hearings?
Well, I'd been sent to New York, not Washington, to open a television bureau, a television news bureau there. We didn't have one, believe it or not, in the States at the time. And within literally a week or so of my arriving for the first time ever in the States, a thing called Watergate started happening. And after about a year or so, it was clear it was the biggest story that ever was. And they moved me down to Washington. Very, very bizarrely moved out of Washington Charles Wheeler, the greatest foreign correspondent of his time. So there was I, callow youth, not yet 30, taking over this story.
And you almost missed the resignation.
I sort of almost missed the resignation because, like everybody else in Washington, during that ghastly hot summer, the Watergate hearings were suspended briefly so that everybody could go on and have a break in August. And I went back to Britain, took my family back to Britain. I was there for 24 hours, and it was fairly clear that things were happening. And I was down in Cardiff with my family. It was fairly clear that things were happening. I went back to London, and they said, you shouldn't be here, should you, boy? And I caught the next plane back to the States, leaving my family behind after a holiday of approximately 1.5 days. And I had a stroke of enormous luck because I happened to know a chap called Peter Pizer, a congressman, Republican congressman, and the next day he rang me and said, don't know if you're interested, but I happen to be at the White House having a prayer breakfast with the president this morning, and he's going on television tonight. And I said, do you know what he's going to say, Peter? And he said, he didn't say, but I figure we know, don't we? And, of course, it was the resignation speech, and I got on to London and said, he's going to resign tonight. Put up a satellite. Big deal in those days. Satellites cost thousands of pounds to put up, as we used to say. And I went in to tell him and said, the president's going to resign tonight. Thank God he did.
And
that would have been the end of my career. Well, I think so, yes. It was a wonderful moment. But pure luck. Do you know, most of journalism is luck.
Well, you say that. A couple of times you've used the word luck in relation to your career. And, of course, a lot of it is tenacity, is working the contacts, working the phones, always making sure that you're there earliest, that your call is in first, that people don't forget your name.
There's a bit of
it's
that.
It's very, 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 very competitive, especially in the field of foreign journalism.
Oh, it's
for
highly
correspondents.
Competitive, and you can't come second. That's absolutely right. But if you're not in the right place at the right time, then that's it. It's luck. It's mostly luck.
What about the desire to come first? The
very you've got to be competitive.
Where does the competition come from in you? Is it a desire to keep your job, or is it a desire to give the other man a bloody nose?
It's very difficult to separate those two. But there's certainly a bit of that in me. I do remember once being based in Salisbury, Rhodesia, as it was, and I was going on holiday, and they sent out another reporter to take over from me while I went on holiday. And I can remember rushing around for weeks, hoovering up every story I could find. And so when this poor chap arrived, there were already 7 Humphreys films waiting to be transmitted on the 9 o'clock news. It was a wicked, terrible thing to do, and I feel only slightly ashamed.
So where are we? We're at track 5.
From the States, I wanted to come back to London, but they said, no, would you mind going down to South Africa to open a television bureau there? Which I did. And it was at a time when apartheid was at its height. Ghastly, ghastly time to be there in lots of ways, but of course a wonderful story for a newsman. And the resistance movement was in full flood. And this was their song, Nkosi Sikelele Africa.
Nkosi Sikelele Africa, Maluphakanyisu thumbo layo, izwa imithandazo yethu. Nkosi Sikelela thina lusapho lwayo.
The Teal Choir and Nkosi Sikelele Africa. So, first of all, you'd taken your family to America. You'd come home even for a holiday, and that only lasted for 24 hours.
Yes.
You'd taken them to South Africa. I mean, how safe were your family in South Africa?
Oh, perfectly safe. I got a bit of harassment occasionally. You know, they'd come knocking on the door. Special Branch would come knocking on the door. A bit of threatening, a bit of tapping your phone and stuff like that, but nothing serious.
Is that why eventually you decided to come home?
No, I decided in the end to come home because I'd had enough of being on the road. I really had. I did not want to live in hotels and on aeroplanes. And I said, that's it, no more. And they said, well, what about the 9 o'clock news on telly? Reading that. Wonderful.
Did you think you would enjoy it?
I did think I would enjoy it. Well, look,
you didn't, famously, of course.
I did not. It was for the first time in my life. I had a routine, a rhythm, a pattern to my life, and I could say to somebody, "Yep, I'll see you next Thursday week. We'll have dinner." Fine, perfect. But it was boring. You go in, you talk about the news of the day, you have interminable meetings. And then when everybody else has gone home and you're fairly knackered, it's 9 o'clock at night, you have to perform. You're on air for about 4 minutes, perhaps by the time you've taken out all the film reports and everything else, reading from an auto cue. Well, it's not a job for a grown man, I'm afraid.
So suddenly...
Or woman.
Suddenly you got a call out of the blue from somebody at a programme called the Today Programme.
The Today Programme.
And what did they say to you?
That's what it was. They said, John Timpson is retiring. At the end of the year, would you like this job? And I said, yes. Boom. This was midnight. I just got...
Literally, one conversation.
One conversation. Would you like it? And I didn't give it a... I didn't even say how much. How much money? I said, yes. Absolutely, yes. When can I start?
Hold that thought and tell me about your next piece of music.
Classical music. For many years has played a huge part in my life. I now listen almost to nothing but classical music. One of the pieces that turned me on to it was the Beethoven Violin Concerto, which struck me at the time, 35 years ago, whenever it was, as being the most beautiful piece of music I'd ever heard.
Part of the second movement of Beethoven's Violin Concerto in D Major, played by Itzhak Perlman with the Philharmonia Orchestra, conducted by Carlo Maria Giulini. So, your interviewing technique on today, then. Let's talk about that.
I have one.
I believe you do. And many people, of course, relish it. They relish listening to you pinning those sweating politicians to the studio wall. Some people, however, say that it generates more heat than light. What do you say to them?
That would be true if you make the assumption that the politician is always there to tell it like it is, to answer your questions fully, frankly, and freely. And if they come in to do that, and it happens sometimes, you let them do it. Mostly, for perfectly obvious reasons, they don't come in to do that. They come in to deliver a message. They argue the case, of course, but they deliver messages. That's the reason they come onto the Today programme. Now, it's not your job to stop them delivering that message, but it is your job to ask them what lies behind it, to challenge it if necessary, and to pick them up if they repeat the point they've already made, if they try to dodge the question you've asked them, if they say things like, well, actually, what people at home want answered is this, and then go off on their own riff. In other words, if they try to deliver a party political broadcast, which often they do, it's your job to say, come off it, Squire, let's have none of that now. How about answering this question? It's a perfectly simple, straightforward question. What's the answer?
Well, during that answer, you said for perfectly understandable reasons,
yeah,
they don't want to answer my questions.
Party
they want
political
to get
reasons, yeah.
But do you start from the basis that I'm paraphrasing now for reasons of elegance, but Jeremy Paxman says he starts from the basis of, he says this is a bit of a misquote, but basically, why is this lying so-and-so lying to
no,
me?
No, I don't start from that, right, on that basis. I don't believe that they're there to lie. There are some politicians who lie, of course. Mostly, in my view, they don't. They want to tell the truth. But I do start with the assumption that they are there for their benefit, rather than necessarily for the benefit of the audience, for the elucidation of the public as a whole. And it's my job, often, to try to get them to be a bit more candid than perhaps they intended to be.
When politicians walk into the Today studio, can you feel when they are scared?
You can feel when they think they're on a sticky wicket. And you can, I think, sense when they are not happy with the policy that they're defending, and that's when they're uneasy. Look, they're pretty bright people, politicians, and to get to the cabinet, you've got to be very bright indeed and tough and aggressive and all the rest of it. But they don't like it if they have to defend a policy that they wouldn't themselves have chosen. And they do, most of them, find that very difficult, and that's what you're able to sense.
So you've been in front of that Today microphone now for almost 21 years, it is.
Exactly 21 years.
Exactly 21 years. You've beaten Brian Redhead's record. Is it true that he tried to punch you once?
Brian tried to punch many people in his time. I once intervened between him and the programme editor, whom he tried to punch in the green room. He didn't actually lunge at me, but he threatened to do so. Brian had a very, very short fuse. A great man, Brian, let me just say this instantly. He was one of the greatest, if not at his, certainly at his peak, the best broadcaster in Britain. But, we all had these little bust-ups with Brian, but it was all forgotten 5 minutes later. Great man.
Is there aggro between presenters about who gets to do what? I mean, if you know, your editor tells you, yes, on Tuesday, the Prime Minister or the Minister or the important diplomat who's not yet made themselves available is going to, how do you divvy it up?
We all want the best interview. Of
yes.
course we do. But by and large, we get on remarkably well. I think that this bunch, the present bunch of presenters on the Today programme, gets on better as a group than any I've ever worked with, and I've worked with a lot over the years, and we get on pretty well, yeah. But of course there's a bit of tension. Be odd if there wasn't. We're competitive. We're journalists.
Creative tension,
creative
let's call
tension.
It. Tell me about your next piece of music, then.
My son, Christopher, is a professional cellist, and when he was a youngster he played for the Reading Youth Orchestra. And his first solo performance was the Elgar Cello Concerto, and I can remember sitting in the front row, squeezing my upper arms with the tension of it, and I feel as if I've still got little indentations in my upper arms from the pressure.
And how old was your son at this
and
point?
And he was 16 Oof. At the time. Yeah, it was terrifying. So I obviously want the Elgar Cello Concerto.
Thank you.
Mstislav Rostropovich playing the opening of Elgar's cello concerto with the Moscow Philharmonic, conducted by Gennady Rostevtsensky. So, John, after more than a quarter of a century together, your marriage with Edna broke down. That was in the late 1980s. And you met your partner, Val. Was it in the Today production office that you met?
Yes, it
was. I can't imagine you having an office romance. Did you find it tricky?
Neither can I. I don't really remember it being particularly tricky. No. It all felt a bit out of character for me.
And you have a little boy, Owen.
Yeah, he's seven.
He's seven now. Were you ready to embark on fatherhood all
Absolutely
over again?
Absolutely not.
I was
ready to retire from all that and look forward to my grandchildren. And I was deeply reluctant to start on it all over again. But it's been utterly, utterly glorious. It's been wonderful. I can't believe how wonderful it's been. It sounds incredibly corny, doesn't it?
No, I don't think it does at all. I remember having my first child around about the same time as you had yours. And although I didn't know you, I remember hearing you say, because Tony and Cherie ensconced in number 10 were also having a child, little Leo was born. And
That's
I heard
right.
you say, I mean, what is paternity leave for anyway? I don't even know what it's for. I swear I threw something at the radio.
Did I really say
yes.
that? Oh,
you sounded rather unreconstructed.
Well, that was before Owen was born.
Right.
And everything changed after that.
Did
I can
it?
Tell you. Well, it did. I just fell completely in love. What a corny thing to say, but I did. Having children as I did at the age of 21, 22, 23 was one thing. Having a child at the age of 57 was something quite different. You view them quite differently. I view Owen quite differently from the way I viewed my other children. It's partly because other things in your life are less important. Your career doesn't matter any longer. You don't worry about making a living and earning the money and paying the mortgage and all that. None of that matters any longer. And maybe that's what it is, because all your attention is focused on this little chap. And I just have found myself utterly, entirely captivated by him. And there really isn't any other way of putting it. I get so much pleasure and joy from him that I find it very difficult to express it.
Do you think, also being the age that you are, you worry about not always being able to express it? And you think, well, maybe by the time he's in his late teens, early 20s, I might not be in robust health, or I might not even be around, and therefore every minute matters.
That may be subconsciously there. I don't think that consciously, because I sort of assume I will always be there, but I suppose. Stupid, isn't it? But it may be more concentrated because of that. I suppose that's possible, isn't it?
Tell me about your final piece of music, then.
Well, it's because of Owen. He, bizarrely, I suppose, at a very early age, showed huge enthusiasm for rock and roll. This takes me full circle, really, because I suppose I started my musical career, if that's what you can call it, with rock and roll. And he absolutely insisted, I know one's not meant to say this on Desert Island Discs because they're one's own choices, but I'm very happy to have given in to him when he insisted it had to be Great Balls of Fire.
Hold me, baby. Well, I want to love you like I love a shoe. You're fine, so kind. Got to tell this world that you're mine. I chew my nails and then I twitch all my thumbs. I'm real nervous, but it sure is fun. Come on, baby, it drives me crazy. In this group, it's just great balls of fire.
One to have Owen dancing round the kitchen. That was Jerry Lee Lewis, Great Balls of Fire. I will give you John Humphrey's The Bible, the complete works of Shakespeare. You're allowed to take one other book. What will it be?
Poetry, the biggest poetry anthology you can lay your hands on. I've never given enough time or attention to poetry. One novel would drive me mad after a week, so it's got to be poetry.
Right, you can have that. And, of course, a luxury too.
The cello. I doubt that I'll be quite up to Rostropovich's standard by the time I leave the desert island, but I want to give it a go. I have tried in the past, failed miserably, but I want to try again.
And if the waves were to threaten to wash away the discs, I'm going to make you choose one that you would save. Which one would it be?
Probably the Elgar, in the end. It'd remind me of the family.
John Humphreys, thank you very much for letting us hear your desert island discs.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For more podcasts, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.